Is everyone here who signed up to do a problem today? You did.
We did, and I don't think anyone signed up to do problem three.
Someone did. Oh, that's right. No, yeah, somebody was supposed to volunteer on the spot. Or at least the three people who signed up to do problems are here. It's possible they're running late too, but we can get started. I guess I should pick up the homeworks from the people who aren't presenting.
And the parts of the homeworks, the people who are presenting, this is going to be recorded.
You mean that keep the exercise of presenting?
Yes, for now. I mean, unless you can do it from memory.
I had to staple the final diagram.
Yeah, it's fine. No, don't work it. Just hold on to it.
Okay.
Are you not taking the course? Okay. You know that by because the class is now just six, that or five plus one auditor. Did you sign up officially to audit? I mean, can you do that?
No, he said he just added for this week, so.
No, your audit, just added or your audit? Just audit, okay. All right, well, if you can sign up officially to audit, that would be good, I think, for the, I mean, the university, I think, prefers that. And whoever, you also haven't signed up yet. Okay. But you turn in the homework anyway, just in case. Okay. That's fine. I'm hoping this class won't be too horribly demanding. I understand. What? Okay. Very good. All right, who wants to start? I guess we should go in order. Who got the first one? All right. You can come and get recorded for posterity. Have your...
Intimidating.
It's exciting. Anyone? Oh, yeah, so you can submit to your parents. You're selected. You can tell me you are selected especially because of your extraordinary intelligence. If you want me to say something, I guess this is not recorded too, so you tell them to skip the first 5 minutes.
Okay.
So maybe restate the problem.
Okay, the problem we have is Bremsstrahlung and synchrotron radiation, which I'm not going to bother writing on the board. Yeah, okay. So the problem is we've got basically an ionized plasma of electrons and hydrogen. The electrons go around, bounce off the protons in the plasma. This causes them to accelerate. That acceleration causes them to radiate light. So the problem is to figure out the magnitude of the luminosity cause per unit volume in terms of the physical constants in the problem. Okay, so basically, we start off with a simple formula. When the acceleration caused when an electron scatters off a proton, remember, similar, we've got proton here, an electron passes by, and then we've got, as with the gravitational problem, we'll define an impact parameter B for the interaction, which is the closest approach. And as the electron's going, it'll curve down like this. Now we can figure out the acceleration caused to the electron just by simply applying Coulomb's law and in a unitless form. The acceleration ends up being proportional to Q squared, because we've got charge of electron times charge of proton, divided by mass of the electron impact parameter squared. mass is just converting from force to acceleration. We divide it by mass impact parameter because force varies with the inverse square of distance. And now, then, to figure out the power emitted when an electron accelerates this way, we take our formula for the power radiated for acceleration. Okay, just to catch up, we're just doing the first problem here. Is charge, specifically of the electron, squared times acceleration squared over speed of light cubed. Substituting in acceleration, we get the power is equal to, let's see, q to the sixth over mass squared b to the fourth c cubed. Right. And now, when the electron's going by, it's only within the range of this particular proton for a certain length of time. And if we just take an estimate here, we're only going for a rough estimate in the problem, we can say that the distance where it's interacting with the proton is also about b. Just it'll be on the scale of b at least. So the time that it's near the proton is simply b over its velocity. So the energy radiated away is simply power times time, which is equal to q to the sixth me squared c cubed b cubed v. Okay, so now what we have is the energy per interaction of an electron with a proton. Now, my instinctive way to solve this problem was to just take the energy per interaction and multiply it by the frequency of interactions, but it ends up not being so clear cut as I found. The catch is, take the energy radiated per interaction, then multiply that by the total frequency of all interactions in the plasma, which should give the total energy radiated.
Total, like the frequency as in like how often it happens?
Yeah.
Or not the frequency as another reading?
Yeah. Two different frequencies, and we'll get to playing with frequencies later. But this way, what happens there is when you multiply by the frequency of interactions, you multiply first through by the density and then by the velocity. Problem is we only have one factor of velocity in the denominator here. We multiply through by that, we get the, well, kind of paradox that the overall radiation doesn't depend at all on the velocity, which means it doesn't depend on the temperature, which just makes no sense physically. So looking into things, I found that there's a bit more going on, which I'll mark that point later, which is where I believe the mystery comes from. Okay, so what we've got here is dE. Now, if we're trying to find the energy per unit volume, so that's dE. So to figure out per unit volume, we simply multiply by the density of protons. Or, well, since we're working with a hydrogen plasma here, the density of protons and density of electrons should be about the same. So just multiply by the density once. So so energy per volume is 2 to the 6 per C³ times a factor of n. Now we have to change this into our end result would be adding in dT at the bottom. So the way I ended up doing this is now we get to playing with frequency. We figure out, add in the unit list d omega dT to this, which is on the same, which doesn't affect the overall order of the problem. And what this omega is the energy radiated in a specific frequency of light. Now, I'll show a bit later why this is roughly constant with omega. But for now, just since that ends up being unitless and not varying with any parameters, we have the same equation with just those extra factors added in on the left side. Okay, so now the goal is just to integrate out d omega. So our final result will just look like that. The reason we have the energy being constant omega comes from the nature of the interaction and the way energy is radiated off. Now, as we have up here, we've got the electron only accelerates for a very brief time scale, and we also know that from quantum mechanics, the light it radiates off is in the form of individual photons. Now, each photon is only sent off in a very short blip of time. So if we were to model the energy radiated off over time, it would end up being zero for a long while, then a very sharp spike where a photon goes off and then zero again. Now to figure out, it would be a sharp spike where probably most of the photons go off because they have to go off at once, otherwise they're going to break conservation of momentum in some way. So we've got a sharp spike where everything's radiated and the electron interacts with the proton. So to figure out the possible frequencies or the chance of each frequency, as it's probably just a small number of photons, we take the Fourier transform of this. Now, going back to calculus in that, we know that the Fourier transform of a spike like this, essentially a Dirac delta function, is flat. We just get an even probability of a photon being emitted at any frequency. Now, the reason this doesn't integrate out to infinity is because an electron moving has a finite energy. Discounting its rest mass, the energy of an electron moving at velocity v is simply 1/2 mass velocity squared. It can't radiate out any more energy than it has. So the maximum energy of a photon that could ever be emitted would have this amount of energy. So even though the distribution says it could go out past that energy, we just put a sharp cutoff there. And let's see. So the energy would be H omega max equals or forgetting about the half. And so we end up with this, and this also works on the negative side too to keep things symmetric. So we only have a finite area of photons being propagated. And as I mentioned before, I think this ends up being what the problem is with my first approach, in that what it's doing there is, I believe what happens is there's an extra factor of velocity introduced in due to simply the problems it causes with electrons running into high accelerations, which would sometimes want to radiate out photons greater than the energy the electron actually has. And this adds in another cutoff. The faster the electron's going, the less frequently this happens. And
there's a cutoff
thing? Yeah, the electron would want to radiate out a photon, which is more than the energy it has. So.
If it's a flat distribution?
Well, it's not really flat. It's actually like a very shallow Gaussian. Like if we model this as a sharp Gaussian, this is a shallow Gaussian. It's just flat for the ease of math we'll do later. Okay, so anyways. With that, we can go back to this. We integrate omega from 0 to omega max, which is mev squared over h bar. Since this doesn't depend on omega, we just multiply. And now we're left with the saner solution, that we have a factor of velocity in the numerator, which once we translate to temperature means the radiation will scale with temperature. Now the final steps are just getting rid of some of the constants we have here. First we'll handle is B. Extra factor of what? Oh, yeah. Okay, so for B, imagine we have a box with n particles. And they're moving around randomly. At any given time, the volume of the box, let's just say V is the volume of the box, and then N equals N over V. Now, at any given time, each particle will have a rough small volume of the box to itself, and this small volume, little V, equals big V over the number of particles, which is roughly 1 over n. So the average distance between one particle and another would be kind of, if we draw a cube around each of these, then the average distance from this particle to another is going to be the cube root of the volume, which will give us the edge. So the edge length, let's just call it L, equals 1 over n to the 1/3. Now, this average distance, since interactions are going on between particles all the time, this average distance we can use as the typical impact parameter B. So then we get B equals n to the negative 1/3. Or roughly scaling with that. Now, of course, some will be closer, some farther, but on average, this is the distance most interactions will take place in. So we plug that in. And get this. Last thing we want to get rid of is the velocity. Now, to do that, typical energies of particles moving at temperature T, we have E being about kT, typical energies. And this is again 1/2 mev². So V is roughly equal to square root kT over ME.
Can you say why it's desirable to switch to temperature from velocity?
Because temperature can be measured a lot easier. And yeah, and there's a lot of dispersion in velocity, and we've got a plasma of electrons and protons. It's not simply feasible to go in and measure the velocity of everything. Temperature, however, can be measured. So then we plug that in. And that gives us our final result of and this is our answer, which has everything in terms of constants. We know charge of electron, mass of electron, speed of light, h bar, k, and the one parameter we have to measure, the temperature. Okay. Now, that's everything for part A.
Right. So, actually, yes. Since the final time, I think we're going to go ahead and go to the next one, and then if we have time, we'll have you come back and do your comment.
Sure.
That's very good. Any questions for Brian?
Yeah.
So how will you estimate? Because I suppose plasma is not the equilibrium space.
Well, in a sense, I believe it would be at some form of equilibrium, and in actuality, it wouldn't be the temperature we're estimating, but rather we'd measure the luminosity and use that to figure out the temperature. And that temperature could be used for, well, whatever purpose you need it.
I think this is, in some sense, an effective temperature that you're defining in this way.
Yeah.
The temperature that enters this formula is, in some sense, it's a little bit of a circular definition. But people really do that, right? They use this kind of formula.
Yeah. Basically, you just take the inverse of this, solve it for T, and then use that to define the effective temperature of the plasma.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah.
does somebody have a particular question on synchrotron radiation?
I can probably turn this in now. Actually, I might need that for the second part if we get. Okay. Well, if we do part B, we're going to get that back. We'll send our fitness.
Can I erase that?
Oh, yeah. No, you have to write it in between. So,
I'm figuring this out as I go about the timing, which is why I'm not sure how long these things are going to take. So it might be better to, since the Eddington limit is more interesting, maybe just skip to part B of this one. Just to go ahead and assume part A and then just do part B.
Okay. Okay. Fine. It's
one of the more interesting results. Well, actually, it's like the Thompson cross scattering. Let's just assume Thompson scattering and write down the final answer and then do part B.
Okay. Well, it's a number.
What?
Should I write the number or just the number of the Thompson scattering or just
the formula?
Okay.
I don't care about numbers. This is a Kroger Institute man. What? Exactly.
Well, this is the scattering of a charge Q. Well, the scattering cross-section of the charge Q. If we compute this for an electron, it would be the Thompson scattering, which is okay. So,
what's that? I can't remember. What's the unit that they use for particles like barns? You know? Does anybody know what this is in barns? What?
I think the
what?
10^-24. 10^-20.
So it's just like 1/10 of a barn?
Well, half a barn. That's 6 × 10^25.
So you have to be able to
half a barn.
I couldn't remember the. Just with the LHC turning on, it's important to remember. They're going to be measuring what cumulative cross sections in like pico barns. Pico barns. Yeah. Carry on.
So we'll look at the Eddington limit in a special case, which is the case of accretion. We've got a mass, M, which is just in a gravitational field. And, it's just moving towards some mass, some greater mass, M. I'm assuming this is the mass, M, and the mass is moving here. Well, this mass is in a gravitational field. Does it have a gravitational potential? I'm just writing the gravitational potential here. Assuming that this mass moves here and at radius r, its potential energy obviously changes to kinetic energy. It just gains velocity. So we can equal this to kinetic energy. And in the case of accretion, if at this point this kinetic energy changes into thermal energy, we'll have radiation. So If we want to see what will be the resulting luminosity, assuming that this has an efficiency, I mean, all the kinetic energy won't change into radiation. With some efficiency, we'll have this luminosity. Well, we see that the mass m is changing with time. And as it changes, it radiates. And we have this luminosity. We might think that we can reach any high value of luminosity by this change. But it isn't the case. That's the reason of the limit, the Eddington limit. This luminosity actually has got a limit. And why is that? Well, as this mass is moving toward the other one, and it's emitting radiation, so thus it's emitting photons. And photons have momentum. So we have a radiation pressure that is in the other direction. So this will be the direction of the gravitational force. As photons are emitted by this process, we'll have another force, which will be the force of radiation in the opposite way. And as this increases, as radiation increases, at some point of time, these two forces will be equal. And then accretion will stop. And because of accretion stopping, we'll have some winds, for instance, going out of the star with a very high luminosity. And so we want to see when this radiation force will be equal to this gravitational force. Should I keep it?
You can go to another one. That wasn't a problem. The levitating board.
Okay, I can understand it falling down, but why does it go up?
The counterweights. The other counterweight, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The counterweights are just.
Yeah, probably is counterweight. Off. Right.
Well, we want to compute number density of photons in the radius R. Obviously, it is the luminosity and 4P R2, which will be the radiation flux. The energy of a single photon. Actually, this will give us the flux of the photons. And we'll call it an R. So as photons are emitted, they will collide with electrons. And as each electron has got a cross-section, and the cross-section of the electron is the Thomson cross-section. Did I say collisional cross-section? So the rate of collisions would be the number density of photons, the flux of photons, multiplied by this collisional cross-section. Okay. Collision per unit second.
There's cross sections and area, right?
Oh, well.
M is 1 over volume. This is actually 1 over a length, right? I mean, obviously.
This is area. Well, this is energy and this is power. So this will be over time. This is area. Mm-hmm. This is area. So the result will be just over time.
So this is. That's not really a number density, unless you.
Oh, I should call it the flux of photons, right? Okay.
That's fine. You don't have to change your notation. I just wanted to point out that point. No, you don't have to. Everyone knows them. Sorry.
Okay.
You can say wait until the next video.
Okay. So. And as in each of these collisions, we have a momentum transfer. And the momentum transfer of each collision will be this. And write the force as. And wanted to see when this radiative force will be equal to the gravitational force. So what gravitational force we want to compute is the gravitational force of a proton that is falling into the gravitational field. So this would be so this is the Eddington limit. Over this limit, the radiative force will be bigger than the gravitational force. and thus we will the star or anything it is will eject some mass out. And as it ejects mass out, it will have the luminosity of the Eddington limit, and we can have many good information about the mass of that object. So that's why the Eddington limit is important in astrophysics. Okay. Okay. So we were also asked to compute the rate of change of m, the accretion rate, in terms of the Eddington limit. So you know from there that L is epsilon Em R. And if we put R as this, so this is the accretion rate. Well, it asks for the time scale of this accretion. Well, the only thing we have is the rate and the initial mass. So what we should do is to divide these two. Okay. We have dm dt m. Well, should I write the final answer? Did I just compute?
You just write out the final answer.
Okay. It's 5 m.
Independent of that.
Sorry?
Independent of that.
Yeah. Okay.
What is the meaning of time scale for equation? That's how long it
takes. Could you repeat the question?
What is the meaning of time scale of equation?
Time scale of equation? Well, as I said, mass is falling into the gravitational field. When the gravitational force is equal to the radiative force, accretion will stop. So we'll have a time scale for it. It will be limited.
Right. So actually, so what it does is it sets an upper limit for the rate which mass enters the object. Mm-hmm. And so if you speed up to go up to that rate, then you start adding mass at the maximal rate. Then there's a finite amount. Then you'll eventually run out of mass. You have a certain amount of mass to start with. You start dumping it into the central object. Then eventually run out of mass. And so this is the rate at which you lose it. So you just take the total amount you started with divided by the rate at which you lose it, time to go from full all the mass.
Well, I calculated the same time scale, but it seemed really big to me. Like, physically, can you give me some information? It just seems really big. A large, a long time.
Then to the eighth?
Years.
Well, this is something falling into the sun.
Maybe black hole.
Well, I mean, well, half a billion years. Think about the lifetime of a star is measured in many billions, at least, depending on the total mass. And this is just the beginning of it, the first step where stuff falls in. Overall, it's a small fraction of the life of the star.
Half a billion years, not that long. That's why it's important.
We're biased.
That's why it's important to do these problems. They're all depends on. Is there anything else you can choose?
Yeah, there was this question. I haven't the question with me.
No, okay. We can go on to the next. It's just peak frequency, right, which comes out of the.
Yeah.
But you can, we can go on to the next. You've done the, you already did the hard part. So, yeah, that's interesting. But unless the peak frequency interesting.
It isn't that far to reach that frequency, just the potential energy. Must we compute that, and we compute, we assume that it's the highest energy photon,
right.
And we compute the peak energy frequency.
And it's like what?
It's 10 to the 14.
10 to the 14.
Gigahertz.
What's that mean? What's the wavelength of 10 to the 14 gigahertz? What wave band is that in?
It's gamma, isn't it?
Very good. Any other questions for Kobe? Or about Eddington? Anybody know about super whenever occasionally you observe super Eddington luminance?
Yeah, one thing that occurred to me might be the cause of that is the assumption we're making here that every electron is bound to a proton. So which means that the photons come out, they hit the electrons, which have the bigger cross section. And then that pushes back the protons, which have the higher mass and are pulled in by gravity more. So if the material is heavily ionized, then the electrons might be blown back more than the protons, and protons could fall in faster, cause more radiation outward.
That would make great charge separation.
Yeah, and then it'll pull the electrons.
So I think
overall, it might average out. Yeah, just be a temporary effect.
The other ideas? How do you get above luminosity higher than this? And so this is actually observed in real space. Luminosity is higher. Any other ideas?
Turbulence, maybe?
It could be evolved. I'm not really. There's various different ways to do it. I think the main one, though, is actually there's an implicit assumption of spherical symmetry here. Which is actually, because you sort of assume that the radiation is going out the same way.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff's coming in.
Like stuff comes in top and bottom, radiation blows up.
I don't think that actually
happens. Up or out of the way.
Yeah, but anyway, I think these systems with these collimated jets.
Yeah.
The idea.
We get mass in a disk and jets up top and bottom.
Right, so the idea is that you have control object. And then accretion is coming in like this, and then the last one, accretion goes like this, and the power goes up. So it's spinning in this direction. Like pulsars are like this, as are active pinion.
Pulsars are they well understood?
Some are.
That's another. I mean, going through all this and the phone, fully all just like, I think you're done.
Okay.
Unless you have something else to say. I have a
microphone.
Okay. So, is anyone on a volunteer to do number three? Or is there anything going to go undone? Anybody else?
Well, I get an angle about 90 degrees, so I wasn't sure if I
The answer is supposed to be focal ratio.
It was the temperature in terms of focal ratio.
Yeah.
So you got a focal ratio of like 90 degrees?
No, the focal ratio is plus like a very, very small, 10 to minus 3.
My focal ratio was 3.
Really?
Okay,
well, it sounds like so we need to get to it. You want to do the problem?
I could show my solution.
I could do 4.
Yeah,
let's go ahead and do 4, and then we'll discuss. We'll do 3 together. This is fine. I'm glad I gave one question at least. It wasn't before.
Because the answer was not at the back of the book.
Mm-hmm. So I'm doing question 4. It's the modified graphical profile. This derivation won't be very similar to Mark's thing.
You can suppress details.
Oh, I like details.
You can give us all the details if you want. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
You are the presenting scientist.
So we have a modified force law. Is this big enough? So the question asks, how long will this system take to relax? It also asks qualitatively, what effect will it be longer or shorter than normal gravity? And immediately, you can see that you're multiplying gravity by a decaying exponential. So the gravity force is going to be weaker, which means that it's going to take longer for the deflections to accumulate. So the relaxation time, you intuitively will think, is going to be longer. And it also asks, can you guess what effect would an even smaller lambda be? Now, if you take lambda to infinity, you recover normal gravity. So if lambda is getting smaller, you're modifying it even more, which means the relaxation time is going to increase. So let's show that explicitly. We've seen this before. We have some system with n particles, and it has a length scale r, and then there's this other length scale lambda. Schematically draw a star here. They're separated by a distance r, and star 1 is moving with velocity 1. There's an impact parameter here, and we'll set this at t equals 0 and x equals 0. Coordinates. And there will be a deflection down this. So for this calculation, I'm going to ignore the near collision interactions. Although their effects are big, the time scale of which they will accumulate deflections with, which will erase the initial conditions, is longer, actually, than the time scale of the accumulated small interactions.
Did you check that again for this
one? I did not.
I don't actually know the answer. Did anybody check?
Yeah, it's not that big. This force law, the way we've set it up with lambda, it's more like a small perturbation to the relaxation time, and the collisions are an order of magnitude larger.
I'm trying to think about it intuitively. Now, gravity would be weaker. So it would affect the long distance.
But as R approaches 0,
I agree. So let's calculate what the small deflection will be. Now we can use Newton's second law or the force, and we get so we have the small deflection per unit time, or for a small amount of time. And we'll use the total force with cosine. Which is B over R, where R is equal to x squared, b squared, and x is a function of time. But we've set x not to zero. So I'm going to pause right there. And I'm going to Taylor expand the exponential, because it's really messy if you try to integrate it, unless you Taylor expand it.
There's no
solution. You can't like integrate by parts.
Actually, when I was assigning the problem, I went and double checked all my integral tables to see if I could make it, if there was any way to do it.
So we have this exponential.
So if any of you figured out how to integrate it, and it's in your homework, then you can publish it.
My calculator gave up on that one, so I'm not bothering.
I tried a bit, and then I'm like, why don't I just Taylor expand it? It's much easier.
That was what you were supposed to
do. Yeah. Now in the question, it says to assume that lambda is of order 10 to the r. So that's why I was like, oh, okay, probably have to. So when you Taylor expand this is just equal to 1 minus b over lambda. Order b over lambda squared, which is of the order 0.01.
Is everybody okay with that? This Taylor extension.
Okay. So now if we put that into the force, we have negative g m squared. And then we'll just plug in our R's. I don't want to write that out. But so now we can plug this into here.
We can move that table.
I can work around it.
You don't have to.
There's not much. So we get this. And then you get some nice cancellation between a little bit at least. So this is, again, for a small period of time. So we have to integrate to get the whole path deflection during this period. Now, I actually don't like solving numerically, so I always try to do integrals by hand.
It's designed to be done by hand.
I think Farbot asked me if I did it numerically. I told him I did by hand.
Unless explicitly asked, you could always do it by analytically, unless it's involved. Like if you could have done the other, if you could have done the full force law numerically, that'd be cool. I don't know if you can.
Yes. I'm writing v squared, t squared over b squared a lot. Yeah. Could have changed earlier, but that's good. So you look at this and you think a bit and you make the substitution as well. Here's this. And also implies that looks like something's going to cancel. We should also consider the endpoints.
Anything we could weigh down that chalkboard with?
All fitting. Is that keeping it down?
So yeah, it is. So if t ranges from negative infinity to infinity, alpha is going to range from negative pi over 2 to pi over 3. You can just see that from sine over. Maybe I'm going long. I'm not even at the total deflection yet, but we have this. Translation here. This will leave you with an inverse or a 1 over secant, which is post. And you're correct. And you see we have our result we had before with normal gravity. And if you take lambda to infinity again, you get what we had before, which is always good to check if you're going through modify. So this is total deflection for one interaction, one gravitational interaction. Now we have to find the number of interactions per passage for one of these objects. Now to do this, we should calculate the effective interaction area that one of these objects has, and then figure out how many objects per area there are in the system. And then you just multiply. So basically, we're trying to find the cross-section of an object. And we'll make it a function of db so we can integrate over the range of b's. We have this. And the area of a ring is equal to just this, like we did before. But when he actually did that, I didn't see it right away, so I had to do it myself. Yeah. So the number of So the number of interactions per passage equal to, as I said before, the number of objects per area times this area, this cross-sectional area. And now we're in the position to calculate the average total deflection of the object's velocity per pass. Again, same arguments as Mark gave. We take square because the first order will give us 0. And this will be equal to the number of interactions per passage times the total deflection of one passage. And that will give us average deflection per passage. I'm not sure where I'm pointing from. I'm probably just putting, might have erased it. It was right here. Right. I'm just squaring that and putting it in. And then get another order of these. And neglect. Now I'm going to pause again, and I'll do the varial theorem to make life simpler. Now, we can't just assume the varial theorem relation because our potential energy has changed. I'll tell you the end of the story. It's going to be the same anyways because you can neglect the term, but you can't just assume that. We have this. Two kinetic energy, potential energy. But what is the potential energy? Our force has changed to this. I'm just going to Taylor expand right away, which is this. And And we know the potential is given by the negative of the integral of the force. So our potential energy is going to be G m squared over R minus G m squared over lambda ln R. Now, ln R over lambda, much, much less than 1, assuming a big enough R. Because remember, lambda goes as 10 times R. So it turns out the variable theorem is the same. We get and g squared is equal to gm n over r. Now we can plug this in here and get 8 over n g squared b. And now we'll integrate over all b's. Our total average velocity deflection per passage will be V max, V min, and this relation inside. Now the question is, what's V max and what's V min? We'll take V max as the large length scale of the system. V max equal to R. Now B min, what's this equal to? This is equal to when our assumptions break down. So it's when the total deflection is of the order of the velocity. Now, here again, it gets complicated because it's modified gravity. But it turns out to be the same. But you can't assume that. So we have equal to V implies and this is from our relation of the deflection from before. So V squared over GM and then we arrange, well, maybe we'll take it a little slow. And we can substitute from the variable theorem our v squared. And go all over the place now. Put it over here. then cancel off the GM. And again, take lambda 2 to infinity, we recover the same thing, so it's a good check. But we can also say here that lambda over r is approximately 10. And n is probably much, much greater than 5. So let's just neglect this term, cancel the lambdas anyway. And we get r over n. So b min. R open.
It's worth saying that here, you know, think about what happens when the lambda goes to 0. What if the lambda goes to 2?
When lambda goes to 0, n is still much greater than pi.
Yeah. But think with the numerator. Lambda goes to 0.
B min goes to 0.
Exactly. Which is, this is how you can verify directly that the strong relaxation for. Even if you have a very strongly modified depth.
So let's do this integral now that we know the limits of it. Lawn, and then you'll get the traction between the two. Just the n. Now, I considered neglecting this term at one point. But I left it in. It's small, but maybe big enough to leave.
Questions?
Yeah, so we don't know what n is. I mean, if we think of a galaxy and we think n is stars, then it's probably big enough. But I don't know, maybe it's the.
I think
I was just, if like n was of the order 10, maybe. If it was like a selection of galaxies. Yeah. I left. We get b squared times 8 on n over n. And this is the total deflection per passage through the system. So now we can finally answer how long it will take. Because we know how much each velocity is changing per passage. Now we can calculate how many passages it will take for the deflections due to gravity to be strong enough to erase the original the initial conditions of the system. So let me just write that down. B squared is going to be equal to the total number of passages. Number times the average deflection for each pass. So call that big N P. I know Mark ran into notational problems. So I had to be very careful.
Learn from my error.
Yeah. So v squared is, so we're just going to substitute that into here. I don't know why I wish I was showing my will be two. And then I'm just going to collect these into a fraction. Gives NP to 1 over 2. And this is the total number of passes required. One step away from calculating how long.
If you want, just at this point, running a bit long, you can say qualitatively how this
thing okay.
Is there, if you calculate numerically
how so long? I'll just write how long it takes and I can do everything. So to calculate how long it takes, you calculate how long it takes for one passage, two passages, and you get. So from here, we remember that the normal Tn was equal to 1 over 8 RV n ln n. So you can make the argument here that n is greater than 1. So this is going to be negative, which means that this over this is going to be bigger than this over this, and this over this is back. So this is going to be bigger because this is bigger. So quantitatively, it justifies what we thought. And then the effect is.
I'm not here. I got the opposite answer. I mean, the relation time will be smaller.
Right. No,
the relaxation time is going to be bigger.
Actually, there are two factors these are comparing. For example, what is the initial condition and then the relaxation per process? And I came to the conclusion that this doesn't vary much, but that is very much suppressed. Initial conditions. I mean, we have V, initial V, if particles coming from infinity, then we have maximum V. And relaxation per passes. So this will be actually this is a over the long range being force is suppressed, right? So we have small v, but this will stay. So relaxation per passes will be almost close to the initial value, but the initial conditions are small.
Now, I think that the assumption of taking particles at infinity might not be true because we're assuming an ensemble already within a certain radius r. Oh yeah.
Right, but as I showed you, I guess the effects could be of the same order. So you're saying that these effects are the same order, but this is bigger?
V will be very small compared to the initial V for the original gravitation.
Which you're saying that the change in time.
Exponential factor, right? This V will be suppressed by an exponential factor, e raised to power minus.
Yeah. Well, I mean, right here, V is going to be the old V minus the log of R divided by.
This is potential energy. Maybe is that confusing?
I think this will be actually this ratio. I mean, the relaxation per process will be almost same to the previous value, but the initial conditions, the V will be small, very small compared to the.
Relaxation. It's not going to be very small. It'll be just very only a little bit small. This is a small. This correction. This is the correct
This is the correction to the original potential energy.
This is a very small.
Assuming R is big enough.
Yeah. This is small, but. These are two competing factors, right?
Yeah. No, they could be comparable. It's possible. But this is not going to be a big correction.
Actually, I got the my transfer.
Okay. Cool.
I was making a less approximate consensus.
Yeah, it's possible. I'll look at your. It's possible. Yeah, I'm not saying it's because this effect could be bigger. This is the effect that I had in mind. If the other effect is bigger, do you want to show it or?
Well, what other assumptions did you make?
Yeah, I think the same, right? But the only thing is that I didn't make the Taylor expansion.
Oh.
I assumed that exponential it is decaying, so we can take the initial. I mean, you have this exponentially decaying graph. So we can take this much as the effective integral.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Take the value, this exponential, anything, and some.
So he took the decay, exponential decay, and then he took some cutoff here.
In the integration.
For the integration.
Which integration?
The initial where you make it an expansion.
So I think he for the deflection when he calculated the deflection for one passage. When he put in his force, mm-hmm. total force, he took a cutoff for the integration.
It's kind of cutoff.
Now I wonder what the difference between this is and the Kähler expansion form I had. Like I wonder if I'm cutting off earlier, maybe, or.
It's interesting. I'm gonna have to think about it. But that's very interesting. I'm not 100% sure until I check, which is
very good.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Is there a way to understand what he was saying?
I did a different approximation rather than taking
a Taylor expansion.
A Taylor expansion. Instead of taking. Rather than taking this as copy to one of the parts where it's in the car, he just said, well, this is just. We're going to be either minus R over R squared. Or. If I understand you properly, it's going to be the force is going to be this for r less than something,
mm-hmm.
and then it'll be zero for r greater than
some part wise, step wise function.
Is that more or less what you have?
Actually, I took the maximum value of this value because we have, I mean. I think the integration was over R minimum, mm-hmm. and some R. R is taken by the. So R naught is plus one in the result of. R0 is the same when you the scale. You are assuming that this is the particle and here is R0. This is coming from the fact that it erases the initial condition. The minimum distance
before. Oh, yeah. Right, I mean that being now.
Yes. So this is very small. So this will be exponential is the best this value. So we can the main contribution to the integration will be coming from this part, let's say. So this exponential integration, so we can take this close to the integration is really equal to RS plus minus R more vector. And then you can get this
and
this doesn't care.
I think that's interesting. Not. Anyway, I'll have to think about it.
concerns?
So for lunch, we can do problem three all together then. I can't remember what the right answer is, so. But I think I remember how to scale. We can work it out. The point is, right, that you start with the sun, and then there's some energy flux. And the point is that if you put a little magnifying glass here, an area A, then that's going to be the collecting area for.
Is everyone content with this? So there's a big area A for the like the A of the solar flux, and there'll be a little area A min. They'll be given by this. It's gonna take me a minute to remember how to do this. And there's going to be some. Right. And so the apparent size of the sun is given by some angle here related to R. Right. It'll be basically the size of the sun, the angular size of the sun. Going to be given by R theta, right? It's R sine theta. That's about. I can't remember if this, I'm going to even use all of this. Okay, so, right. And so then, from here, you're going to focus down again and have some little image of the sun that will be on the the wood or whatever, right? And so again, so this distance here, another name for distance, d, is going to be related to. So the focal distance is equal to. The focal length divided by the diameter of the. So. So this will be F, right? And so this, right. What?
I did this wrong.
That's possible. I don't know. I can't remember how to do it. I'm going to see if I can recall. Anyway, so. Right, we actually aren't going to use this, are we? The flux. The energy per unit area per unit time. Is that correct?
Yes.
Anyway, this is goes to.
That's a definition.
Right. I think this is the relevant one. And so the flux. Here will be just so the energy that goes through this length. Shoot, I can't remember how this goes. But I don't think you have to do that, though. I think that you can do it more simply. I should have brought my solution. I have a solution that I worked out before. Anyway, I'm pretty sure all you need here is, this is the power per unit area. And so then what becomes relevant is the flux into here. Okay, so does anybody remember what did y'all do at this point? I can't.
Okay, I can go through my solution if you want.
That's okay.
What I did was that flux we're getting from AT to the fourth would be the flux at the surface of the sun. And as we go away, that spreads out over a larger area, so mm-hmm. drops off as inverse squared. So
right.
I divided that down by, square of the ratio of distance from the Earth to the sun, but over the radius of the sun. Okay. And can I peek at this? To...
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. Anyway,
yeah, so does the radius of the sun or the radius of the Earth come into your answer?
Radius of the Earth does, and it's negligible.
Radius
of the sun does.
The radius to the Earth?
Yeah, radius of the sun and radius of the Earth's orbit are
right.
the big ones.
Yeah, so those actually don't enter into the answer, okay. turns out. Because this definition of force, of flux, is important. Actually, I'm going to go... I should get the actual answer because I should have brought it with me. I can't remember now. But because the point is that what comes in here is that this flux it's conserved. So it's just like the even though because this is per unit area. Yeah, sure. You can, come on.
I'm not sure
if it's possible. Go here. Hold on.
I just said that the luminosity of the sun is 4 pi r squared sigma t effective power 4.
That's right, yes.
And then I said, this luminosity is the same at the surface of the Earth. So I just said, t to the power 4. These two luminosities are equal, luminosity is the same.
Or d is the distance to the Earth?
Yeah, for this to there. So I just use that, I equate these two equations, and I find temperature at the surface of there. Which I don't remember how it was, but something around like 200 Kelvin or something like that. Sorry, Fahrenheit or something like that. It is still very high, so I was wondering if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I use the, for the effective temperature of the sun, I used it in Kelvin because 5700 centigrade of the fluxes mm-hmm. before deflection and after deflection, which I said cosine theta over here is flux before deflection plus after deflection, mm-hmm. and conjoint theta is equal 1 over 2 Fokker ratio, and I just use that to find the Fokker ratio, but I'm not sure.
Right, well, let's hear. I remember the final answer, but I can't remember how you drove it. So, do you want to write down your. Do you want to write down the answer?
Yes, I do. But the focal ratio is very small, so. That's the table over there. It's very huge.
Oh, I see. Where did you get that data?
Because cosine theta is the ratio of fluxes
Oh, I see.
And use the 800 degree, 800 point for the
okay, if this is, this looks really.
Anyway.
Why is the beta not canceling? Okay, this is really yeah. What you did is very close.
You're right.
Like, there's some.
I should reflect post secondary plots over plots.
That's probably right.
I suppose this square was just. Can the sport of this wood some kind of area and calculate the plots from this wood from this?
You mean you take into account the area of the lens?
Yeah, we can. Area of flags, the area of the wood, right? So the flags from the lenses. And it's equal to this is the luminosity of the lens and the total energy going to the wood will be. In proportion to cost.
That's a proportionality or somewhere? No, it's times, okay.
Yeah. Same as. I'm not sure about the spec.
Yeah, I think, well, I see where you're going. I'm going to have to get the actual solution, which I shouldn't remember, but it's
and this means that it should be square.
Right, I think that it's actually, I think it is actually linear. I think she's right, but I'll demonstrate that after. It's fine. Very good, thank you. I'm sure, yeah.
It's all
okay.
So
this is, isn't it funny that like, geometric objects is harder than like
I still think it should depend on the distance from the sun.
What?
I still think it should depend on.
She's right, because the thing is that this is right. The luminosity is what's
relevant and it goes by like r squared. So you add it, or actually it's gonna go by like r cubed, it'll be you sum up the whole energy coming out of the sun
mm-hmm.
and then it's gonna be constant. And the
well,
flux.
Yeah, but we're only capturing a small portion of it. And
right.
That portion depends on how far away we are.
Yeah, no, but so this part is just gonna be constant. We didn't demonstrate, but it plays a key role. All right, so we're out of time for the morning. So we'll come back. Was 12:30 too soon for y'all last time? Or is that okay?
I mean,
Yeah. Would you rather come back at 12:30 and then leave early, or do you want to like come back late and leave at 2?
I've got a class after it.
So you'd rather start.
12 plus 2, but I've got half an hour. Half an hour would be sufficient for me.
Okay. All right. Well, I would rather just go ahead and meet back at 12:30 and then let out early. If that's okay with you. Okay, very good.
Discuss this afterwards?
Yes, I will get the resolution of this problem. I was expecting some one of you all to solve it, and so I didn't prepare. So I also have your next problem set, which you can either take now or later, depending on what you prefer.
I'll just grab it now.
Should we give the
problems we solve?
Yes. Please give in all of your. Okay. Can I get yours as well? Okay.